She said that, you know, we cried for the first 2 weeks of the war, and then we decided time to get back out and helping people.
The head of Catholic Relief Services talks about humanitarian crises in times of war, as his organization pinpoints the top humanitarian hotspots of 2024.
We all thought we were going to die. We said, okay, this is it. We are all going to die. But thank God we survived.
EWTN News In Depth travels with a Catholic aid agency to Turkey as we mark the one-year anniversary that killed tens of thousands and displaced nearly 2 million people. What's the situation now? Some highlights from this week's National Catholic Prayer Breakfast. And are you ready for some football? So are the bishops of Kansas City and San Francisco. Some lighthearted smack talk, all for a good cause this Super Bowl weekend. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
I think it's important to remind everybody that this country is still in the midst of a brutal war and that its people continue to need help.
The humanitarian needs of people living in countries at war. As we approach the second anniversary of the war in Ukraine and 4 months into the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, the humanitarian crises in war-torn countries continue to draw new attention. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. Catholic Relief Services, the International Relief and Development Agency of the U.S. Catholic Church, has released its most pressing humanitarian cases to watch in 2024. For an estimated 360 million people across the globe, these crises reflect deprivation, loss, and disruption of their lives that will have a ripple effect for years to come, all because of circumstances beyond their control. CRS says only 20% of the $55 billion financial need is being met, with millions of people falling through the cracks. In its 8 global humanitarian crises to watch in 2024, Catholic Relief Services puts the war-torn countries at the top of the list, Gaza number 1 and Ukraine number 2. The food crisis in East Africa is number 3. In Somalia alone, half of all children are expected to be acutely malnourished this year. Escalating gang violence and climate change effects in Central America put it at number 4, with economic collapse driving large numbers to flee. Earthquake destruction and displacement in Afghanistan ranks it as number 5. Fighting in Sudan has destroyed homes, businesses, and schools. It is number 6, as more than half of its country's population needs humanitarian assistance. Conflict and violence combined with a food crisis in the Central Sahel puts this African region at number 7. And a global uptick in preventable diseases, including measles, tuberculosis, and malaria, place climate change-induced disease spread at number 8. We begin our in-depth focus on these humanitarian crises with a look at the dire situations in the war zones of Gaza and Ukraine. Rizal Rages has our report.
Millions of people displaced from their homes. Some continue to live in war zones, while others evacuate and seek shelter elsewhere, often lacking food and water. These are the humanitarian costs of war, devastating both Gaza and Ukraine.
My house was bombed, and I fled here without bringing anything with me, not even money. We need food, bread, and blankets. It's winter, and I came here without anything, not even spare clothes.
Since the start of the war in October, after Hamas terrorists brutally killed more than 1,200 Israelis on October 7, and Israel struck back with airstrikes against Hamas in Gaza, a humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza has escalated, with Palestinian civilians caught in the middle. Catholic Relief Services, the official international humanitarian agency of the Catholic community in the United States, designates Gaza as number 1 on the list of global humanitarian crises to watch in 2024.
We've done some food commodities, some shelter supplies, some hygiene products, and then they were checked, verified, and then they'd move on. And we've assisted over 100,000 different people there, 22,000 families, and doing about 800 or 1,000 a day in that area.
CRS President and CEO Sean Callahan was just in Gaza last week to assess the situation. According to CRS figures, nearly 2 million people, about 85% of Gaza's population, have been displaced. Many have crowded into schools, churches, hospitals, homes and shelters, but thousands are living outside without safe shelter. Callahan explains that a lot more work needs to be done as more and more people fleeing from fighting in the city of Khan Yunis are headed towards the border of Egypt seeking refuge.
You are seeing, you know, some of these really beautiful families that are together, but you also see that displacement and then trying to take care of those children during this time where you can't trust the food, the water, and you don't have the proper medicines. And it's particularly poignant for women who are pre and postnatal, women who are ready to give birth, and then women who have given birth and trying to take care of their newborns when they're not getting adequate nutrition.
The latest Integrated Food Security and Nutrition Phase Classification, or IPC report, states that more than 90% of the population in Gaza is facing crisis levels of food insecurity and warns that level of hunger could lead to famine in as little as 3 months. Children, especially young ones, are especially at risk from disease and malnutrition. Living in a tent with her family, this mother with a four-month-old baby is forced to feed her baby ground-up rice and biscuits because they could not find or afford to buy baby formula.
Because there is no milk and we no longer buy milk, since 2.5 months ago we started feeding her. She is supposed to be forbidden from eating until she is 6 months old, but because there is no milk and the child is hungry, there is no alternative.
Other organizations, such as the World Food Program, provide meals and deliver food to as many people as possible. So far, they have been able to feed around 1.4 million people.
There are people starving in areas, and we are not able to give basic food for. The needs are rising faster than we are able to respond. We need to be able to bring in more supplies, and we need safe access to reach people everywhere in Gaza, not just those who are close to the borders. We need a long-lasting ceasefire to stop the suffering.
Honestly, I was very scared. I screamed so much. I've never screamed like I did this morning.
In Ukraine, attacks continue as the almost two-year war rages on. Coupled with a bitter winter, there is an urgent need for life-saving humanitarian aid.
14.6 million people, 40% of the population in Ukraine, will need humanitarian aid. 4 million people are internally displaced. That's in addition to those who are externally displaced.
According to a UN report, more than 3 million people are living in the middle of war zones. In Donetsk and Kharkiv regions, families live in damaged houses with no piped water, gas, or electricity.
Unfortunately, the war, you know, continues, and every day means, you know, unfortunately, more damaged infrastructure, more destroyed homes, more lives that are being pulled apart.
This puts Ukraine at number 2 on the list of Catholic Relief Services crisis to watch.
At the beginning were very basic needs, ensuring that people have access to a place to live, whether for a few days or sometimes a few months or longer, access to hot meals, food packages, hygiene items, providing cash assistance to households.
CRS Partnership Coordinator Eric Heinonen works with the Caritas organizations in Ukraine to provide aid both in the country and in neighboring countries hosting refugees.
The Caritas organizations in neighboring countries like Romania and Poland and Hungary and Slovakia and Moldova are really focused on how can they help refugees integrate to the degree that they want to and just get to a level of stability to be self-sustaining where they are.
So far, CRS and the Caritas organizations have helped a combined total of 3 million people.
Look.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, recently spent a week in Ukraine. After seeing firsthand the continued toll the war has on Ukraine, he said he worries that Ukraine is being forgotten as other global crises take the spotlight.
Look at the headlines. Sometimes you cannot find Ukraine anymore. It means that there is less attention, less resources will be allocated to help the people and more suffering for the people that remain here caught in this senseless war.
Rasel Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
Beyond the humanitarian crises in war zones, as we told you, Catholic Relief Services also highlighted the broad issue of disease spread, a crisis only made worse by a rapidly changing climate. Africa remains a hotspot for many of these preventable but deadly diseases, including cholera, which is now seeing a resurgence during the continent's rainy season. The World Health Organization says transmission is active in 14 countries, shown here in orange. The six African countries shown in red are currently in an acute crisis over the cholera outbreak. The Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Mozambique, the United Republic of Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Pierre Burgos joins us now to provide an on-the-ground perspective to the outbreak. He's the Humanitarian Response Technical Advisor for Catholic Relief Services Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene Program, or WASH. Pierre, it's so great to have you here with us, and thank you for doing the work that you do. The African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says this is the worst outbreak of cholera Africa has had in years. What are you seeing on the ground in the region?
Well, indeed, it's a very concerning and unprecedented situation. So in the Southern African region, we have seen up to 6 to 8 countries hit by the ongoing cholera outbreak. And the World Health Organization has been reporting until 200,000 people affected by the cholera disease and around 3,000 fatalities.
Wow.
Cholera outbreak.
No, that's a lot of human beings, sorry.
Yeah. The problem with cholera is that's a very severe disease which spreads very quickly in areas and which can kill a person in less than 12 hours. It's often linked with poverty, with the lack of access to water, sanitation, poor access to health facilities, which is extremely concerning in the context of those countries affected today.
Right. And how does climate change then impact the spread of diseases like cholera?
Well, indeed, climate change has been increasing the situation. So the cholera outbreak we are currently in started mostly last year due to a series of cyclones, especially Cyclone Freddy, which hit the coast of Mozambique. And has been so the cholera outbreak starting mostly due to these cyclones and with more and more frequency and intensity of such severe cyclones we see more and more frequent outbreaks such as the one we are living today. Cyclones are bringing a lot of rains, so floods, and with these floods, water contamination. But on the other side, other phenomena such as El Nino are bringing more droughts, which are leading families to fetch water from unusual and often unprotected water sources and exposing themselves to diseases such as cholera.
In addition to natural disasters, you also have a couple of other roadblocks. Regional conflicts often block the delivery of aid and the building of water wells. What other factors are worsening this crisis? And how are these diminishing resources and regional conflicts playing a part in this?
Well, indeed, it's a very, very difficult situation because of a mix of several factors. Between them, we can mention COVID-19, malnutrition, and the poor urban planning, let's say. So COVID-19 has been really overstretching public health facilities and public health systems in many countries. And over the past years, during the pandemic, these health facilities and this health system were unable to put in place the usual immunization and vaccination programs. And that's how we are today seeing this increased numbers of cholera cases. On top of that, the Southern African region is seeing persistent chronic malnutrition situation. And we know that children affected by malnutrition are more vulnerable to the effect of cholera diseases. This situation of malnutrition is closely linked to the global food crisis and closely linked to global geopolitical situation. And finally, as I just said, the cholera outbreak is linked to poor urban planning, meaning that in this in peri-urban areas of big cities such as Lusaka or Harare, there is often poor access to water, sanitation, and people have to walk long distances to fetch water. And our team in Zimbabwe were witnessing and sharing with me today that people have to walk long distances to reach health facilities. So in the treatment of cholera cannot happen on time.
Right. So then how do you identify which people or communities are most vulnerable? You talked about the three different kind of ways and places that this manifests itself, but how can you reach them and identify that they're vulnerable to this?
Well, today the problem, the major problem, is the scale of the situation. So the outbreak started with cases in peri-urban areas, which are more or less accessible. But today the outbreak has been reaching rural areas, which are often very complicated to reach. So the way CRS and partners are reaching and targeting those people has been through the local communities we work with every day, and through a strong network of partners and organizations with the Catholic Church at regional level and at local level. We have this strong network which allows us to reach all the areas where the outbreak is currently ongoing.
Right. Well, Pierre, the bishops in Zambia recently expressed solidarity with their country during this outbreak. What role does the local church play in a crisis like this? You mentioned other partners, but the Catholic Church, what does it do?
Well, the role of the Catholic Church is extremely important. And just to remind us, the Catholic Church is the first health sector in the world and in Africa. So indeed, we have, as part of the Catholic network and the Catholic Church in Southern African countries, has a great role by the network because they are implemented in many communities, and especially in remote communities. Very often, the only way to get access to health services is through the Catholic Church and their health services. So it has really an important role in tackling the current situation.
Well, thank you for your work, Pierre. We'll be sending you prayers, and our viewers are watching for more updates. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we continue our overseas inquiries about people in need when an EWTN News in-depth crew travels to the destruction zone in Turkey on the first anniversary of the massive earthquake there.
You can rebuild the house. You can rebuild, you can buy furniture, you can buy, you know, material stuff, but you can never gain those people that have lost their lives in this earthquake.
1 year after the strongest earthquake in Turkey in centuries, we go back with a Catholic aid agency to check on recovery efforts.
Being able to help young people to find into faith is, the joy of my life.
How one German bishop is trying to spark hope and joy in his country's young people, seeking to evangelize them into the Catholic faith.
Well, I want to know if Bishop Johnston is wearing his cap.
He is. He's wearing his cap. Oh! Yes! Here we go.
Buckle up. Some Super Bowl wagering, Catholic style, up ahead.
Prayers for the dead, 1 year after a massive 7.8 magnitude earthquake rocked parts of Turkey and Syria. Millions marked the somber anniversary of the disaster that leveled towns and cities and took the lives of tens of thousands of people. The impact continues to reverberate today, with many still homeless and millions in need of humanitarian aid, living without basic services like food, water, sanitation systems, and health care. EWTN's Vatican correspondent Colin Flynn traveled to Turkey and gives us an on-the-ground look at how families are still coping.
Breaking news, an earthquake on a terrifying scale. Officials say it's a magnitude 7.8 quake.
All it took was 80 seconds for more than 13,000 buildings to come crumbling down. 80 seconds for homes, offices, factories, and entire cities to be destroyed.
In southern Turkey, buildings crumble like...
The physical destruction is immense, but the human toll is harder to comprehend.
In February of 2023, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake devastated this part of southern Turkey and northern Syria. 60,000 people lost their lives in what was the deadliest earthquake this country has seen in 1,500 years. I'm standing in the center of the city of Antakya, where this time last year I would have been surrounded by buildings and people's homes. Now, just piles of rubble. And the buildings that are still standing, they're so weak and dangerous, they have to be torn down. But for the people who survived, their lives will never be the same.
In the region of Iskenderun, one of the worst affected by the earthquake, everyone remembers that night vividly. Like Ifran Siran, a local shop owner.
What do you remember from the night of the earthquake? What was it like?
It was 4 o'clock in the morning, 17 minutes past 4, and suddenly everything started moving. It was a very frightening thing. We shook for 1 minute, just like that. It went on and on.
At a time like that, what goes through your head?
We all thought we were going to die. We said, okay, this is it. We are all going to die. But thank God we survived.
Ifran is one of the lucky ones. His building survived and so did he. But he lost 11 cousins and relatives in the earthquake and the aftershocks in the following days.
My sister's daughter was buried under the rubble for 4 days. Let me show you. The concrete ceiling collapsed on top of her, and she was stuck just like this for 4 whole days.
For those who did survive but had their homes destroyed, many have ended up in camps like this one.
This country is facing an unprecedented homelessness crisis.
2 million people are living in camps after the earthquake. 80% of them are women and children. They live in tents and prefabricated rooms.
What do you remember from the night of the earthquake?
I remember waking up to find the whole house shaking. We felt so much fear. We were terrified. It was after I got out that the building completely collapsed. Everything was gone.
Nice to meet you. How are you?
I remember the house started to shake and we ran out.
And what did you feel?
I was so scared when the house shook.
This family is from Syria, but have been living here in Turkey for 10 years after coming to escape the war. They had a home, but now that is destroyed. And with no money, this is the best they will have while they wait for another option. The mother does not want to show her face on camera.
How can we care for our children in this situation? They have to go outside and walk if they want to use the bathroom, sometimes at night, in the dark and the cold. There are no services here. My 9-year-old boy wants to leave the camp, but what can I tell him?
So what is your hope for the future, your dream for the future?
My wish is to leave this camp for something better, we hope, God willing.
In a different part of the camp, another family shows me around their tent.
This water is for washing dishes. We fill this barrel and use the water to wash.
And you use for cooking over here?
Yes. I'm the same as everyone else here. Do I like it? No. But what can I do?
When you see the physical destruction, even a year later, so many towns and cities still in ruins, it's hard to imagine how a country with a struggling economy is going to pay for this mammoth rebuild. There's also the question of negligence by the construction industry. Why did so many buildings completely collapse while others remained standing? They were all hit by the same earthquake. Emotions have been running high in the country as evidence has emerged of construction companies having cut corners or ignored regulations. People want answers and they want justice. One of those 13,000 structures destroyed was the Catholic Church of the Annunciation in Iskenderun. Father Antoine Ilgit is a Turkish bishop who ran into the church at 4 a.m. that night.
When you ran inside the church from your home, was there still rubble falling? Was the ground still shaking? What was it like when you entered the church in that very moment?
No, everything was gone. It was like this. I climbed up on the rubble and looked out over my city. And then the first thing that I saw was the statue of the Madonna, which was intact. On the other side was a statue of Saint Anthony of Padua, who is my patron saint. That too was intact. These were truly the very first signs of hope for me. Then, with the help of the sister, we immediately went to the tabernacle and took out the Blessed Sacrament. And to our amazement, that too was intact.
Immediately after the earthquake struck, the Catholic organization Malteser International sprang into action, providing food, hygiene packs, funding, and other essentials to the survivors. Nejad Sheikh is the country coordinator.
We have distributed food baskets as well as hygiene kits, both for our Turkish response as well as our Syria cross-border response. People still don't have dignified housing. Some have lost everything they've had and need to start from scratch. We have a huge refugee community here in Turkey. They came and escaped that war, came to Turkey, and then they have to survive a natural disaster that nobody has even, you know, imagined it will happen.
So it's like one thing compounded on top of the other.
On top of the other, on top of, exactly.
Some families fled the area straight after the earthquake, like Erdink and Rosemary, who moved to Istanbul and are now living above a Catholic church.
If it was just one place that had been destroyed, everyone could have gone to help. But everything was destroyed at the same time, and everyone needed help at the same time. So there was nothing anyone could do. There was nothing we could even do for ourselves. The only thing we could do was pray to God.
So you came here to Istanbul. Is the plan to stay here in the city, or do you eventually want to go and head back home?
After the earthquake, we no longer make plans. Because we always had a plan in life. My wife and I always had a plan. But God showed us that those plans can change. And very quickly. So now we don't make big plans for the future. We just eat our daily bread and continue our daily lives. That's why we're actually very happy right now.
The survivors of this tragedy have their lives on hold, putting on a brave face and waiting for signs of hope.
What keeps you going? What gives you hope for the future?
Hope gets sort of crushed, especially after the earthquake. You're not the same person as before.
But you want to fight for a better future.
Well, I'm trying. But first, we have to leave this place, and then we can think of the future.
Let's take a look now at the state of the...
And as the wars in Ukraine and Gaza dominate the headlines, humanitarian groups here feel the stories of this disaster and its victims are being overshadowed. They want to make sure that these people who have suffered so much and have so little are not forgotten.
You can rebuild the house. You can rebuild, you can buy furniture, you can buy, you know, material stuff, but you can never gain those people that have lost their lives in this earthquake.
And for Father Antoine, it's hard to preach about God's mercy at a time like this. But the fact that he found the tabernacle intact on that night of the earthquake is a sign of hope for him.
Bishop, what do you say to people who are trying to cling to hope and their faith when they look around at such devastation in their towns and their homes and 60,000 people killed, and they think, why would this all-loving, all-caring God send this my way?
The Holy Father asked me the same question after the earthquake. He said, it will be difficult to preach about hope to your community. And I confessed to him that, yes, it would be. But I think there is an intrinsic strength in humans, something that the Lord has placed within all of us. And even when we go through experiences like this, earthquakes, wars, and other challenges, the Lord is always with us. He never abandons us. He stayed in the tabernacle during that earthquake, saying, I am here. I am with you.
In Turkey, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
And there is still more to Colm's report. You can see an extended version on our social media channels. Be sure to like and follow us on X, Instagram, and Facebook, and watch any missed broadcasts of EWTN News in Depth in full on the EWTN YouTube page and on demand wherever you download TV and mobile apps.
When you're publicly religious, some people think you're a saint, some people think you're a jerk. Probably you're some of both, depending on the day. Don't let either opinion define you. Just keep repenting and move toward the former.
Next, we take you to this week's National Catholic Prayer Breakfast in Washington and bring you words of wisdom from this year's award recipient, law professor, author, and EWTN friend, Helen Alvarez.
On Thursday, more than 1,000 people from around the world gathered in Washington, D.C. for the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast. The event brings scholars, politicians, religious and lay faithful together to pray a Divine Mercy chaplet, invoking God's divine mercy for our nation and world. Speakers reflected on this year's theme, Be of Good Cheer, the Eucharist, the Source and Summit of Our Faith, and looked ahead to the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis this summer. In his keynote address, Bishop Robert Byrne from the Diocese of Springfield, Massachusetts, emphasized that a Eucharistic revival requires a revival of the sacrament of confession.
The Eucharistic revival requires a new encounter with the mercy of Jesus Christ. That moment and every moment of absolution is a renewal of spiritual innocence. A renewal of spiritual innocence. To allow the words of healing to make us like children again.
The National Catholic Prayer Breakfast also recognized Helen Alvarez, author and legal scholar, with the Christi Fidelis Laici Award for her exemplary service to the Church as a lay Catholic. In her decades-long career, she has written extensively on the beauty of the Church's teaching and the dignity of women, marriage, and the unborn. Alvarez has been a frequent guest on EWTN, providing legal and spiritual expertise. We take a few minutes now to look back at some of the most profound insights she's shared with our viewers across several EWTN programs.
The fact that we have a significant number of people who are Catholic or from the Jewish faith on the court is this incredible testimony to the intelligence of these religions. Yes, you know, other religions are very intelligent as well. But the fact that Catholics and Jews have risen to this point in the court in the United States, especially in recent times when previously both religions were really kept off the court, demonstrates that the people appointing justices think that there's something really geniusy about the marriage of faith and reason in Judaism and Catholicism. These are people who believe in a radical equality and dignity of all people, that all people are equal because they're made in God's image, that justice is owed to all.
In the Casey decision, the court says, listen, we don't think people can, or women can be equal without access to abortion. This is really the great lie, that abortion causes women's economic and social progress. It's really a terrible thing to say about women and about progress, if you think about it.
Sometimes people will say to me, oh, Helen, you know, you're so religious. Everything you do is for the Church. And I think to myself, what is the proportionate response to, you know, a God who made everything and then died gruesomely to save us and gives us the gift of our life and everything on the planet? And my vocation is as a scholar, so this is my giving back. If we really want to take a Good Samaritan lens and care for those strewn on our path, we actually have to start with the boyfriend or girlfriend we do or do not commit to sexually. The person we marry, the child we conceive, and do we or do we not bring them to birth? The child we conceive, and do we or do we not give them a stable mom and dad in their lives? Can you think of any more Good Samaritan behavior that affects other people indelibly, deeply, probably for the rest of their lives,
than these decisions about the people strewn in our path. I try to put together the social justice agenda and our thinking on sex, marriage, and parenting as one piece married under love of God and love of neighbor.
Because it is one piece.
It is one piece. And the church tells us that we have to come to understand who God is, how he loves us, and how we love one another through the lens of men's and women's relationships and parenting. Otherwise, why the references beginning to end of the Bible about God as the bride and we as the bridegroom, about God as the father and we as his children who must love him like a child loves a parent?
Abortion is really a conversation about whether we respect other human lives, whether in particular we respect vulnerable lives, whether we are willing to take responsibility for the lives given to us, whether childhood, motherhood, family, you know, our future is of importance to us in the United States. Mm. And in this context of respecting reality, the interdependent, you know, good Samaritan mutual care that is required for those strewn on our path, we ask you to consider our pro-life proposal. We ask you to consider extending protection to the unborn. You know, America, my state, whoever we're talking to, that we would like to protect that life from its beginning, right? From its very beginning.
Right.
But we also will do what is feasible at this time with the understanding that we don't stop there.
Right.
That we do everything we can until we can convince you in this pluralistic democracy of the same respect for human life that we feel. I just think, Prudence, that a conversation about, you know, which weeks or which protections that does not include an exhortation toward respecting, you know, the structure of human life and our need for one another and our care for the vulnerable is not a winning conversation.
Congratulations to Helen for being honored with an award recognizing her fidelity to the church and her selfless and steadfast service in the Lord's vineyard. News headlines are next in the Week in Review, and a German bishop shares his hopes for bringing young people into the church.
Americans are ticked off that this is not resolved. And they expect us to get things done. So why don't we do that?
Republican Senator James Lankford, one of the main Senate negotiators of a border security and foreign aid package, chides his Senate colleagues for blocking the bipartisan bill from advancing Wednesday. The 49-50 vote fell far short of the 60 ayes needed to take up the bill. That failure of the bill to advance after months of intense negotiations tops the Week in Review. In addition to including measures demanded by House Republicans to cut the record numbers of illegal border crossings into the United States, the proposed legislation included $60 billion in wartime aid to Ukraine, $14 billion for Israel, and funds to support Taiwan. But with its failure to advance, Senate leadership uncoupled the border security measure and put forward for a vote on Thursday the foreign aid portion alone.
On this vote, the yeas are 67, the nays are 32. Three-fifths of the Senate, duly chosen and sworn, having voted in the affirmative, the motion upon reconsideration is agreed to.
And with that vote, the Senate proceeded to move forward a foreign aid package with assistance for Ukraine and Israel, with 17 Republicans joining Democrats. Majority Leader Charles Schumer says the Senate will stay in session until the job is done. The vote to advance the bill sets up days of debate on foreign aid and potential amendments before a final vote would be scheduled. If the bill is eventually passed by the Senate, it would go to the House, where it's unclear when or if Speaker Mike Johnson would hold a vote for what the Biden administration is calling critical emergency military aid for Ukraine and Israel. President Joe Biden is voicing his sharpest criticism of Israel's military attacks in Gaza yet, calling Israel's airstrikes in the refugee city of Rafah, quote, over the top. An estimated 1.5 million people have crammed into the city that borders Egypt in hopes of escaping the war, as we showed you in our report at the top of this program. Israel says Rafah is the last remaining Hamas stronghold, and it needs to send in troops to complete its war plan against the Islamic militant group.
Airstrikes overnight Thursday into Friday hit two residential buildings in Rafah and sites in central Gaza. Reports so far allege 20 people have died. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will evacuate the population ahead of a ground invasion. It stirred international condemnation, with warnings from the United Nations that a ground offensive could lead to war crimes. Netanyahu has rebuffed international criticism of the civilian death toll, saying that Hamas is responsible for endangering civilians by operating and hiding in residential areas. Netanyahu also argues that to surrender to the terror group's offer would be to invite disaster, and declared that only military pressure would secure the release of the Israelis being held captive in the Gaza Strip. The strikes in Rafah come just one day after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken returned from his fifth diplomatic mission in the Middle East since the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war. He held crucial meetings in Tel Aviv to press for a ceasefire deal in Gaza, but left without a hostage deal. The proposal sent by Hamas was deemed unrealistic by Israel and the U.S. Blinken said Hamas asked for concessions that were absolute non-starters, but does see hope for the future.
What I can tell you about these discussions is that while there are some clear non-starters in Hamas's response, we do think it creates space for agreement to be reached. And we will work at that relentlessly until we get there.
The full Hamas response proposed hostage release of women and children and the sick in exchange for Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. A 45-day pause in fighting, complete withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, a massive humanitarian effort, and freedom of movement for people throughout Gaza. I recently spoke about the state of the German church with Bishop Stefan Oster of the Diocese of Passau, Germany. He was at the SEEK conference in St. Louis, hosted by the Fellowship of Catholic University students, leading a group of young Germans in search of renewal in their faith. We first talked about the importance of evangelizing and giving hope to young Germans during a difficult time.
What is happening in Germany with the young people?
Well, that's an interesting question, because we have traditional groups of young people. We have a huge group of altar boys, for example. But this is something that belongs to something that we call Volkskirche, church of the people in a certain structured way. And we have the idea that this is more or less dissolving, more or less disappearing slowly. And we try to somehow start some new initiatives also with young people who are there and who are hungry for the gospel and for encounter with the Lord. And there are some places where it happens now, and some of them are charismatic, not all of them, but it's there. It's not a big number, it's not a mass movement, but it's there and it's growing.
Now, I think the global church, when they think of Germany, they don't think of charismatic movements. So even though it's small, can you tell me a little bit about what that looks like? What is the charismatic movement in Germany?
Well, for example, there is a young community, it's called Loreto Movement. I think they don't differ very much from Mexican or Italian or other charismatic movements. They have the same toppings, you know, living in the Spirit, being baptized in the Spirit somehow, you know, healing and prophecy and having pictures in mind and all that. But it's also deep and honest, and it's connected with music a lot,
yes.
You know. So it's not so much different from, and it's emotional. And it's also, you know, we have the challenge to give them depth and also to lead them into silence and so and all that. But those people who feel attached to that, I experience them as very fresh and hungry also and enthusiastic. And some of them are here.
How does that make you feel? Does that give you anything?
Yeah, well, I'm a Salesian, you know, a Salesian of Don Bosco, and being able to help young people to find into faith is the joy of my life.
Now, when you think about young people coming to Christ in these huge ways, and you look at what's going on in the church right now, secularization, the fallout of the sex abuse crisis, it's not really a place where young people can find home.
Yeah,
and yet. you're seeing something different in Germany starting to grow and blossom.
Yeah.
Should that give the global church hope?
Well, yeah, we are here to find hope. And if there's something in a church in my country that gives hope, I think God is working everywhere. And I found some bishop colleagues and they say, well, you give us hope. And I say, no, you give us hope. And so we support each other. So,
you encourage each other.
It's one church, you know, it's wonderful to have.
Amen. Yes, yeah. It is. What can the global church learn from Germany then, as we encounter some of the same things, or we start to encounter in the deeper effects of secularization?
Yeah, interesting. I'm not sure. I think we tend to do things thoroughly. You know, sometimes not very how to say it, not sometimes not useful. But for example, how we try to deal with the abuse crisis. This is really thoroughly and very transparent and very trying to really understand what happens and trying to change. Some of our responsibles try to somehow do it all through structures, which is not, I think it's not the best way. We need to re-evangelize to the new evangelization. We need spiritual depth. We need deepening of faith. And then if once you deepen faith, then the structures change from inside, as it has always happened in the church history. But it's also about structures, you know.
Is it about a conversion of the heart? Is it a rediscovering
always,
of Jesus Christ?
Always, it's always, yeah. But you cannot order it, you know. You cannot convert yourself. So you just can make spaces, atmosphere, can create communities, and you hope through prayer and encounter that it happens. But you know, you cannot ask people to convert. This is difficult, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The German church has been in the news a lot.
Yeah.
Because of the synodal path, which is not related to the effort that the global church is a part of with the synod on synodality, the synod on listening. What can we learn as we apply those new methods of listening? What has the German church taken from the global synod?
Do you mean what? I take part in the synod in Rome.
What have you taken back?
The process that Pope Francis takes us on is about listening and going into depth and to overcome polarization and overcome being enemies because just you think different from. No, we are together. We are church, and we try to walk together. That's what he's doing, not on a superficial way, but he tries to do it on a deep way. And I hope it will be also fruitful for the church in Germany. But it takes time. You know, it's now there were 360 people in Rome sitting together, trying to
for a month. For a month,
yeah. But, you know, going home and telling people how it was, you know, that doesn't mean that they immediately understand and would do the same, you know, for in all our process that we have. So it takes time, and we need to be patient.
What is it that you would love to see? What would you love to change?
You know, one really important thing is joy, you know. I would hope for a church that is full of joy, and people come to us and ask us what makes you so joyful. So and even if we are small, I would hope that we are joyful, so because we know Jesus.
Amen. Amen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Bishop Oster for his insights on the German church. In the weeks ahead, EWTN News in Depth will provide coverage of the upcoming meetings in Augsburg and developments relating to the controversial German synodal path. This Sunday, Pope Francis presides over the canonization of Argentina's first female saint. Blessed Maria Antonia of St. Joseph was proclaimed venerable by then Pope Benedict XVI in 2010 and beatified by Pope Francis in 2016. Blessed Maria Antonia's life included administering care to the sick and poor, traveling around Argentina by foot to safeguard and promote Ignatian spirituality and organizing retreats. She also established the House of Spiritual Exercises in Buenos Aires. You can watch the live canonization mass of Blessed Maria Antonia right here on EWTN this Sunday, February 11th at 3:30 a.m. Eastern. It's the biggest weekend in American sports, and you just know two sports-loving Catholic leaders in Kansas City and San Francisco want to be a part of it.
Good evening, Archbishop.
Good evening, Your Excellency.
Oh, boy.
A little friendly back and forth between two bishops as their cities vie to become this weekend's Super Bowl champs. A sports bet coming up.
The San Francisco 49ers face off against the Kansas City Chiefs this weekend in the Super Bowl. City bragging rights are at stake, and so is a lot of money. Americans are expected to wager an estimated $23 billion on the big game this year, according to the American Gaming Association. So we joined in the fun, Catholic style, by asking the bishops of San Francisco and Kansas City if they would like to make a wager of their own. Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone of the Archdiocese of San Francisco and Bishop James Johnson of the Diocese of Kansas City St. Joseph are here to make a little wager on the big game. Welcome, both of you. Bishop Johnson, your Kansas City Chiefs are the returning champs headed into this Super Bowl. I'm sure your city is revved up. And the Chiefs kicker, Harrison Butker, is outspoken about his Catholic faith and his pro-life convictions. What are your thoughts on his example as a faithful Catholic man and his evangelical influence?
Well, Harrison is what we often refer to these days as a missionary disciple, in my opinion. He takes his faith seriously and strives to live it and is not hesitant to try to lead others to the good news of Jesus. And he uses his platform as a well-known pro football player and maximizes that in a beautiful way, not only speaking about his faith, but also about living as a Catholic man. So he's done a great job with that.
Well, he's certainly giving you all a lot of visibility. Archbishop Cordileone, the 49ers faced the Chiefs in 2019 when they fell 31-20 to Kansas City. Is there hope for this rematch?
Oh, there's a lot of energy. We're ready for a comeback. This is the comeback team. They've had brilliant come-from-behind wins, and we're ready to come back this time around.
Well, with your prayers, I'm sure that they'll be trying. Well, I'm going to ask each of you a more personal question. Bishop Johnson, you go first. Do you have a patron saint that you're asking for intercession for the big game?
Well, of course, our diocese is named in part for St. Joseph, and so he's one of our patrons, and I just don't think you can go wrong with St. Joseph, who is the patron of the Universal Church, the protector of the Holy Family, and our patron, so we're going with St. Joseph.
Ooh, that's beautiful. Archbishop?
And we obviously have our own patron saint here in San Francisco, St. Francis of Assisi, a patron saint of so many wonderful things, certainly a patron saint of peace. So we pray for peace, good sportsmanship, and that through sports we can build up more goodwill and unity in the world.
Oh, that's beautiful. Wow, I don't know which one I'm going to choose. Last question, and the one that I think everyone has been waiting for. Bishop Johnson, for last year's Super Bowl, the Chiefs versus the Eagles, you made a bet with Philadelphia's Archbishop Nelson Perez. The losing city would pay $500 to the winning city's Catholic Charities. Do you have a wager for this year?
Yeah, I think we've got a good one, and Archbishop and I have agreed that it's going to be a two-parter. If we lose, Kansas City Chiefs lose, which is highly unlikely, but if we should, I'll be sending Archbishop a gift pack from our American Jazz Museum. We're noted not only for barbecue, but also jazz, and I understand Archbishop loves jazz, so we're going to send a gift pack from the Jazz Museum along, and this is the second part. We've agreed to support the Pregnancy Care Center of the winner's choice in each diocese so that we can focus on the importance of the gift of human life. And so that's what we'll do. We'll I'll support the Resource Center for Moms in Need and their babies out in San Francisco if we lose. And I'll let Archbishop respond to what happens when the Chiefs win.
Archbishop?
Well, when that year comes around, I'll let you know. But,
All right. What's your bet?
Well, yes. So we want to hold up our love for mother and child, for women in these crisis pregnancies and very difficult conditions. And each of our dioceses have outreach. We have the Bella Wellness Clinic here in San Francisco. And I believe you have its Alexandra House in Kansas City. So we did not decide on an amount. I kind of think that might be determined by the final score. But I'm doubly looking forward to the 49ers win as a lifelong jazz aficionado, and no more appropriate place for a jazz museum. As you mentioned, Bishop Johnston is famous for jazz being the birthplace of Charlie Parker. However, in that unlikely event that I do have to give Bishop Johnston the other part of the gift, San Francisco is famous for many fun things, one of which is Rice-A-Roni. So he will be gifted with a case of Rice-A-Roni in that case.
A wonderful, wonderful return. Well, I think that your hearts as pastors and as keepers of your flock are really shown in this bet. And I will be praying for all of you and asking every EWTN viewer to send up their prayers as well for this important game. Thank you both.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
God bless you. We're wishing the best of luck to both teams. No predictions here. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. See you then.